I had to pick a side, George. It was an aesthetic choice as much as a moral one. The West has become so very ugly. Don't you think?
Can't I ever consider having you take over the circus?
I'm not a bloody office boy.
What are you then, Bill?
I'm someone who's made his mark.
Mais c'est tellement nouvelle cette chanson française qu'il faut que je lis toutes les paroles parce que elle vient de la faire il y a trois jours. Elle a seulement trois jours. Et c'est pour ça que j'ai les paroles ici. Mais je vous promets que depuis aujourd'hui, elle va être très populaire en France. Vous voyez. Je pense.
La mer qu'on voit danser.
Hello and welcome back, after long last, to another episode of Tinker Tailor Podcast Spy. My name is Tyler, I'm one of your hosts, and I'm joined by one of my co-hosts, Max.
Hello.
We are here today to discuss a very special, special treat, which is the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy movie from 2011. Unfortunately, Emma couldn't make it today, but she is still alive and well, and she will be back as soon as she's done getting interrogated in Odessa or wherever.
Yeah, we're about to launch a mission to get her back over the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Once we get her back over the wall, she'll rejoin the pod. But this episode's been kind of a long time coming. We've wanted to do this one for a while. We've been very busy with life stuff, and for some reason, our sponsorships aren't coming through quite as quickly as we would have liked. So we can't quite do the podcast full time yet. So, you know, if you're a big, what kind of company do we want to sponsor us? Cereal? That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I would take like some Cheerios money or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll just take some Cheerios. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, if you just paid us in a few boxes of Cheerios, we could probably do this full time, I think.
Totally.
So yeah, we wanted to do this for a while. It's obviously, eventually we will get to the book. The book is like, it's kind of the holy text in a way, right?
Granted, I still have not read everything.
Yes.
But kind of on purpose because I don't want to finish all of them. But
yeah.
So far, and I don't expect this to change, it is my favorite book.
Yeah, and I think I'm with you. I mean, there's a few that...
I mean, it's up there, yeah.
But I think if you just had to say, pick one Le Carre book, it's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I think.
And I think it's that for a lot of people. I mean, it's probably that or Spy Who Came In From the Cold for most people.
I think Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the nice thing about it is it's... And I think this is one of the reasons why we'll talk about why the movie maybe wasn't as successful as we would have liked.
Yeah.
But it's certainly a much more complex plot, right?
Yeah.
Like, Spy Who Came In From the Cold is pretty straightforward. There's a couple twists and turns, but really it's pretty easy to understand. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, both the book and the movie are very complicated. I remember even, you know, reading it. And you know that thing when you're reading kind of a complex book and you have that thought of, am I stupid and I'm kind of not understanding this? Or is it purposefully meant to be complex still at this point and you haven't, you know? But I remember even reading it trying to figure out what's happening. It certainly is not a fault of the writing. It comes together very clearly. And by the time you kind of figure out all the bits and pieces of what has gone on, it's amazing, but way more complex, right?
Yes, way more complex. This is actually my introduction to George Smiley. I had friends who told me to read him, and you know, he had been on my list, and then the movie came out and I was like, oh, this is great. It was actually came out right around, I'm not even sure if we were dating yet. We might've just gone as friends, but my wife and I went. It was the first movie we ever went to.
That's funny.
And I came out of it like just in love with it. Like, I love it. And she hated it. She was
That's literally almost the exact experience that I had. Like, So I was talking about this with Aaron last night, but we were trying to figure out like when, because I was saying, oh, I just watched the movie again. Do you remember when we watched it? And she said, I don't really remember. And it was interesting because it was relatively early in our relationship, but it must have been a couple years because we watched it at my parents' house with my parents. And I was so excited for everyone to see it. I was like, oh, this is one of my favorite books. You're going to love it. Spy movie. And after the movie was over, I think my mom fell asleep and my dad was like, I have no idea what the hell happened. So I had almost the exact same experience, which was a fun. It both was sad because you knew that that's probably the experience of most audiences.
Yep.
But at the same time, maybe you felt that that was exactly how it should have been in a weird
way. I mean, this is, I think this movie is probably one of my favorite examples of why I like rewatching in movies and also the book, rereading books, because it's one of those movies where every time I pick up more that I missed. And it's still like, you know, I'm not watching it every day, so like, or even every month or whatever. It like still is able to hold me, like the story, and like keep me on edge. And
It's still fun, even though you know,
it's
still super fun.
Who the traitor is and who the mole is. It's still like every, you know, it's like pointing at the screen and going,
yeah,
that's George Smiley.
That's the mole.
That's the mole.
That's John Le Carré singing.
Yes, exactly.
This was the first time I think I watched it knowing that. So that
I think so too. I found that out. I think I probably found out when you found out. So.
Yeah. Because I've seen the kind of still, like the image of him.
Yes. Yep.
But I'd never actually seen the movie cognizant that that was him. So that was kind of cool. I mean, you know, so first of all, I guess a couple of things from, I guess, more of a production standpoint. One thing we both noticed before we started filming is one of the production companies is called Carla Films with a K. And I looked it up to see, this is a very specifically named production company. Have they done anything else? And no, the only movie that they have produced was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy in 2011, which is interesting. Part of me wonders if they thought, hey, this is going to be a hit. We're going to make the full Smiley Carla trilogy. And then we're going to go on and do all the Smileys and make kind of the MCU, the Smiley extended universe,
yep.
I guess.
Yep.
The film. That's a weird thing. In my mind, it was a flop, and I think it was, but I don't really have a great concept of that.
I think it was. I mean, it looks like it made money because at least on Wikipedia, it says the budget was $21 million and the box office was $81.2 million.
Oh, hey.
So that's not like, I mean, that's not, you know,
it's not Marvel.
And Marvel movie, but like that's, I mean, I don't know movie counting and I know that doesn't include advertising, but I can't.
Yeah.
It seems like they made money off of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine $60 million on advertising, so they must have made some money.
I'm guessing part of it is that also, I mean, a lot of people in the movie have become a lot more famous.
Yes. So that's one thing we'll talk about quickly here. We'll roll through some of the names. Because the cast is one of those classic British kind of character-driven ensemble movies where every single actor you know from a million things, and a lot of them are just insanely good. So you have Mark Strong, who, interestingly now, he seems to have settled into a role of kind of just a villain. He's just a bad guy. He plays Jim Prideaux, really good. John Hurt, legend. Plays Control. And that's honestly, like, he was a perfect Control. Like,
yes.
Completely perfect cast. I would say, honestly, I think everyone they cast was perfect.
I think everyone is great. The one complaint I know a lot of people have is that Gary Oldman's great as Smiley. He does not look like Smiley.
No,
like
he doesn't look how he's described in the book. Yeah, he's
and like handsome. I am, and I know there are people, there are certain Le Carré heads who don't like this movie, which
that's crazy.
They're big. I know there are people who are big fans of the Alec Guinness series.
Yes, which we are going to do.
We are going to do, and I'm sure it's great. I just haven't watched it yet. But I think coming from that, you know, sometimes when you have like an idea in your head from a previous adaptation, it like can
And maybe if you're older too, and I mean Alec Guinness is obviously like very.
Yeah,
he probably, because I've seen bits from that series, he probably maybe fits the look a bit better. But
yes,
I mean, honestly, the Garrett, we both were talking as we were watching the movie, and I don't have glasses, but one of the first things I did was Google like where George Smiley glasses, and I found the company, the like the store that I guess Gary Oldman went.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, I watched about half of the commentary for this, and apparently one of the things they said was when he buys new glasses, the person who's doing the eye test is Gary Oldman's son.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
But like this is something I kind of just picked up on for the first time, and that's probably because I am not that observant. But
no, neither am I.
I knew he changed glasses, but yes. It never clicked to me that it was like, oh, you can tell it is a flashback by the glasses he is wearing and it is interesting, you know, it goes from much lighter to much darker glasses, kind of, you know, same from light to dark. And
that's so interesting too, because that's one of those things where very brilliant kind of storytelling tactic, but you could also see why an audience wouldn't have caught that.
Yep.
And past things, they'd be like, wait, is this? Because I remember watching the movie with my parents and Aaron and having to say, okay, this is in the past. This is present.
Yep.
I think one of the, I was trying to remember exactly how it goes because I get mixed up with the book and the movie now. But in the book, the actual Prido, like kind of the opening scene effectively in the movie when Jim goes to Hungary and gets captured, that scene you don't actually get in the book for quite a long time, if I'm not
mistaken. I think it's fairly, I don't think it is in the beginning.
No, it's like closer to the end, I think, that you actually see that scene. So there's a couple interesting things like that happen that make sense probably from a movie perspective to kind of drive the plot a bit faster. But okay, so hold on. So we got Mark Strong as Jim Prideaux. We got John Hurt as Control. We've got Gary Oldman as George Smiley, who is great. Yes, maybe that doesn't bother me at all.
No, I
get why maybe people would be annoyed by it, but he looks old and, you know, dorky enough.
Yeah,
I guess.
I think he looks, I mean, the one thing I think he doesn't have, he doesn't look schlumpy, but he does look like, you know, a civil servant. And it works really well. And I am very pro movie adaptations making changes where it makes it work better as a movie rather than being kind of slavish to the book. Agreed. Sometimes that can work, like True Grit is like basically exactly the book, and it works. The new one with Jeff Bridges is basically exactly the book and it works really well. But like a movie like this, I mean, make some changes. There's not that many, but make some changes from the book, and I think it really helps it work better as a movie. And then you have other movies,
something where, you know, in the book when they don't describe the physics. It's not as though every time Smiley comes on, they're like,
no,
piece of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
But they don't hit you over the head with it. Whereas if they adapted that to a movie, he's in, you know, all, you know, half the scenes in the movie. If he's this like schlubby guy that isn't very fun to be around,
totally.
Maybe it isn't quite as compelling on the screen, right? So anyway.
Okay, I keep it.
And now we've got our kind of schlubbyish guy. We've got Toby Jones, amazing actor.
Amazing, yep.
As Percy Alleline, who's perfect as him. This actor who I'm sure he's been in other stuff. I don't know, but David Densick is his name?
Yeah, I think he's one of those guys I've seen. He's amazing. And so he's his like awesome nondescript accent of like...
Yeah. He's supposed to be Hungarian, right?
He's supposed to be Hungarian, but also...
generic Eastern accent.
I mean, Toby Esterhaus is supposed to like speak like every language.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think it works as like a guy who is... He's worked for every side of every... You know,
every war,
yeah.
And then Sirian Hines, another. The other thing I'll say is they picked, I mean, outside of Oldman and Firth, they picked every actor who has the most unique looking face.
Yep.
But Sirian Hines, no one looks like him.
No. No one looks like Toby Jones.
Yeah, no one looks like Toby Jones. I mean, even this David Densick guy has a really specific look. The one, another actor, I've got his name because I'm looking at the IMDb. His name is Zoltan Muski. He plays the contact that Jim Prideaux meets in Hungary, the guy who's like buttering his bread.
Oh, yes.
He's such an interesting looking guy, yep, too. I mean, crazy. Anyway, and then Colin Firth plays Bill Hayden, maybe he's my favorite.
He's perfectly cast as Bill Hayden.
Totally perfect. Benedict Cumberbatch, who is really good as Peter Gwillem. And then like even small parts, like, so Stephen Graham, who, if you're our age, you probably know Stephen Graham from, why can't I think of the movie? The
Pirates of the Caribbean?
No. I can't believe it. It's so, Snatch.
Oh, Snatch. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's amazing.
Yeah, super good. And even in this, like, very small role, but really good. It's just like, I'm trying to think if there's anyone else totally notable. The guy who plays Lacan.
Oh, McBurney,
like, he's been in a ton of stuff. Oh, yeah. And then, of course,
I was going to say, you missed the big one. Yeah,
the craziest one. So Ricky Tarr is the name of the character. Very small part, but very important part. It's played by Tom Hardy, who, I mean, this was pretty early on in Tom Hardy's career.
I think this is pre-Bane.
Oh, for sure. It has to be, right?
What year did Dark Knight Rises come out? Was 2012, the next year.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. There you go, the next year. So this was like before his big breakout. You know what's interesting? So he did Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. And then that same year that Warrior movie came out where he was a super yoked UFC fighter.
That it is also because like in... This is like pre him getting super yoked. He looks so skinny. I guess
He was in Inception the year before this, which I wouldn't have realized that.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, but
he wasn't like a lead in Inception.
No. Dark Knight Rises was when he became like hugely.
It's when he became Tom Hardy. And then 4 years later, Mad Max. He was Max.
Max, exactly. And then he did like. Well, I mean, everyone knows who he is now, but
yes, yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty, really interesting. I mean, I've seen it, you know, 5 or 6 times, the movie, but this, I haven't watched it probably for 2 or 3 years or maybe more. And
I don't think so. I haven't seen it. I had like a year or two ago had bought the 4K ultra high definition Blu-ray of this when it went on sale, and I was like, oh, I'll get a Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
And I never did. And so yesterday, or like a few days ago, I had finally had the excuse to go buy it.
But you don't have a TV. That was the problem.
I do have the TV. Okay, yes. It was great. It was great. It looked fabulous. So I highly recommend it.
I mean, it is a very, so the director, I guess, last thing, a guy that I don't know, Tomas Alfredson.
I discovered he did the Snowman movie. I left you all the clues.
Yeah. Mr. Policeman. Okay, one thing I'll say. The Snowman book. I love the Snowman book.
I have not read or seen it. I just know the memes.
It's really good. Like that the guy who wrote the Snowman novel, I can't remember his name, but he's like the big dog of the kind of Nordic noir.
Okay, okay.
Scene. And he's written probably like 50 books or something. And I've read probably 5 of them. They're all really fun. Like, and The Snowman is legitimately a really fun book. If you're looking for like a vacation read, crime thriller, it's really good. He directed the Let the Right One In, which I assume is.
I mean,
he's done some stuff.
I think this is I think this is like the only non-Scandinavian movie he has done.
Yeah.
I mean, when I, the commentary, he has a very strong Nordic accent.
Oh, does he? Yeah.
Yeah. He speaks like all Nordic. He speaks English perfectly.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah. Better than we do. Yeah.
Yes.
The interesting thing about it, and to Tomas's credit, is it looks awesome, I think. It's a period piece, and... You know, I think they did a really good job of nailing the period without needing too much kind of over the top costume drama stuff.
No, right? It's really, and he does talk about this in commentary a bit and from articles I read, it's really, he does, it's so much in the background. And he said,
yes,
the palette, he conveys it with, he said his palette is basically brown and orange. Yeah, and that's like that is just so powerfully 70s.
Oh yeah,
but it's not over the top. It doesn't,
and it's
like,
not cheesy 70s.
No.
Everything is like the coolest version of the 70s.
Yes.
When you're in the
I mean, you don't see bell bottoms.
No. You just see like nice suits and hats and ties. Everyone looks awesome. Ricky Tarr's outfits are amazing. Oh,
they're impeccable.
They're so good. Everyone looks awesome all the time. And then probably I think the one of the coolest sets in any spy fiction is like the top floor of the circus.
Yes.
Where they've got like, and I don't, maybe they do this, I don't know if they do this for real, but all of the offices are kind of these separated cubes. So they're not attached
to the
walls. So they can, I assume, like check them for bugs all the time and stuff.
Yeah. And I think they have like, you can see on the interior, they have like that sound baffling foam.
Yes. Yeah. One of the cool little details I love that was a very kind of 70s thing was, so they've got kind of the dumb waiter that sends files up and down floors and things like that. And, the lady on the top floor who, the secretary who kind of picks up the file, she's got this kind of wheeling file cabinet, but then the file cabinet is kind of a mid-century modern, like wooden cabinet. Yep. And, you know, if you saw that thing today, it would be, a plastic or metal looking thing, right? It would
totally be very
utilitarian, but it's this little push cart that has this beautiful wooden file holder on it. The details in those scenes are amazing. They also get away with, just due to what the story is, they never have to shoot any huge scenes. So it's usually small rooms, alleys, garages. Like there's no big scenes they have to fill with tons of extras. So given it's a period piece, it was probably relatively easy to do.
I mean, it's like there's this is John le Carré, but it's, you know, it's a spy movie, there's a single gunshot at the very end of the movie. And it's not a fight. Well, like, it's just
two gunshots.
Once
there's the gunshot during
I forgot. Yes, during the beginning, the very beginning. There's two.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I guess three. There's three. Because
the funny thing about that is it's basically one gunshot right at the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the very end, like the last shot.
Yeah.
There you go. They must have planned it that way. I'm amazed that there are, what's the way to put this? I'm certainly not surprised, I guess, that it wasn't hugely popular. Like we said, it seemed to
have been funny. I'm more surprised it got made.
Yes.
Like, this is, I guess, maybe I'm more surprised it got made as a movie. This seems like, because the first adaptation was a miniseries too, it seems, and like every other recent le Carré, well, not every other, but a lot of other recent le Carré adaptations, particularly of his older books, have been like Little Drummer Girl have been miniseries too. I think it's great either way. I'm glad they made it a movie and they but you know, it is kind of, I'm kind of surprised it got made as a movie.
No, I totally agree, but it's also not a 3-hour long movie, and somehow they managed
it's shocking.
It doesn't feel, well, it certainly doesn't feel rushed. I would say that a lot of people's problem with the movie is probably slow, but it's definitely not rushed, but it really gets the main beats of the story, and it doesn't I didn't feel that it was missing anything. Now, having said that, we've both had experiences watching it with people, as we've said, and it wasn't as easy to grasp. So,
and I do remember, because I had not read the book before this, I do remember loving it, but also Googling it to read about it to make sure I understood what had happened. Which I get, you know, it's not a movie you can just like throw on in the background. Like it is something
you have to pay attention. Even on a rewatch. So
there's
so many scenes. Like when I'm trying to think, you know, George Smiley's kind of introduced when you know, so we see what Jim Prideaux stuff, and you get a bit of the intro to kind of Control. And then the scene almost right after that is when Control is effectively fired, being head of the circus or Secret Service.
I love that scene because it is very funny, because Smiley obviously did not know he was also being fired, because he's like, and what's happening to Smiley? And he's like, he's coming with me. And you see Smiley like just like, what? Like, look at him.
Oh, okay. That scene's great. And the funny thing about it is, and this is how I think all the character development is really well done. Smiley doesn't say a word in that scene. And then he doesn't talk for...
No, that was...
I think it's like 8 or 10 minutes, and
it's 19 minutes into the movie, because they brought this up in the commentary. His first line is 19 minutes into the movie. It's when they go to Lakin's.
Right.
He does not talk until... Because even when Gwillem comes to get him, he's watching TV, and he just hears a knock at a door, and they don't talk there. They just go...
And then there's the scene when they're in the car, which is one of the great scenes where there's a bee in the car.
Yes.
And Gwillem and I can't remember the name of the other guy.
Mendel.
Yeah, Mendel. They're both kind of swatting at the bee. And then George Smiley just kind of calmly opens his window.
It's like a perfect, it's a perfect distillation of what Smiley is. Yeah. Like, just like taking in the situation.
That whole kind of 10-minute chunk where you're introduced to him, you've pretty quickly get an idea in the scene where Control's leaving and Smiley's leaving of who the other people are around the table, kind of what each of their personalities is kind of like. You kind of know Percy's had it out for Control. You know that Bill Hayden's kind of the suave, funny guy that everyone likes. You get that sense really quickly about all of them. So they're built really well. And then George Smiley, this amazing stretch where it's just all... him kind of going about his day doing tasks. I think that's when he gets his glasses and all this kind of stuff. You spend all this time with him. He doesn't say anything, but that's such a great way to construct and build up his character. It's amazing. Like I watching it this time, I just was thinking, I just don't think you could have done this movie and accomplish what they did in a 2-hour movie much better, frankly.
I don't think, I can't see how you could. It's also, I think the fact, you know, you see that he doesn't talk till 19 minutes into the movie just like shows how much of an ensemble cast it is, even though it is a Smiley movie. But I mean, that's the same with like so many of the quote unquote Smiley books.
Oh,
like,
for sure. Yeah.
He is not in a, maybe like, in most of them, he's not really the main character.
No. Like, I wonder if in Tinker Tailor, he probably is in it more.
It's probably this and Smiley's People are the ones where he is, like, the most prominent.
The two, like, the Call for the Dead and whatever.
Yes. And, yes, because they're...
books really.
Kind of yes which are great, but they're different books. But like, I mean, he's in like 3 or 4 scenes of Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and he's in like what did we do last time, the book about the department, the failed
Looking Glass
War. Just like, you know, he's in like 3 or 4 scenes too.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, those are.
Yeah, but that again, I think in a weird way, I think that's why people like.
Oh, no, it's a man. Yes.
He's this important character, but John Le Carré doesn't make him. Not that he is like James Bond in the sense of what he does, but he doesn't even make him kind of the star necessarily.
Nope.
Books that he's in,
but he's like integral to everything.
Yeah, exactly. But that kind of fits his character perfectly, right? And I think this movie does that really well. There's so many important scenes that where obviously Smiley's not there. There's so many scenes where a lot of the storytelling is done with kind of flashbacks, other people, a lot of kind of monologue type scenes. Like I'm thinking especially of when Ricky Tarr kind of relates the whole backstory of how he found out about the mole and all this kind of stuff.
And then I think my favorite monologue is when is Smiley recounting meeting Carla.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's just so good.
An incredible scene.
And also amazing that they don't take the easy bait and show Carla ever.
Yeah. Like, or Anne.
Yeah. Or Anne.
You see Anne from the back.
From the back.
Yes.
But same as Carla, there's the scene in Hungary where they zoom in on him. He's sitting kind of near Jim Prideaux and he's got the lighter, right?
The lighter. Yep.
And that's, I love that they do that with both Anne and Carla, who are both these kind of, it's almost this weird love triangle between the three of them.
Yep.
And that those two pieces, they're almost two parts of Smiley's psyche, well, and they don't show them. I love
they're
that.
They're like two main things driving all the action. And
yeah.
Indirectly driving all the action, and you don't.
There's nothing. I mean, you know, this is kind of the Alfred Hitchcock playbook thing, right? Is if you want to build up a truly scary monster or bad guy, the worst thing you can do is show them. The best thing to build up the tension is just having people talk about how scary they are. That's way more effective than actually, like, every kind of mid-budget horror movie that has kind of a monster in it. They're fun and they're scary. And then as soon as the monster, like, you know, in the last quarter of the movie shows up and they have the fight with it and you see the monster, it's bad.
That's Well, that was like, I still like the movie a lot, but like the double V witch. Like, I loved it until the end when there's like actual witches and she like flies into, I'm like, what that like.
Yeah. What? It kind of cheapens a bit of the tension.
Yes.
Yeah. No, totally. So I think that was, again, you know, I just have to give the writers and the directors so much credit for really, it feels like this was something that they really loved and they wanted to adapt it in a way that, because you could have seen an adaptation of this that was effectively, we need to make, we need to make this more James Bond and less George Smiley. And
yeah, I think
find a way to make it more actiony, and they didn't take any of the bait with that. It's such a better movie for it.
They could have totally like World War Z'd it. Like if you've read, if you've read the book, it is so completely different from the movie. Like the movie is like an action zombie movie.
Yeah.
And the book is literally, it's like, it's modeled after, I'm blanking. There's it's a series of like recollections, like, it's like of like different characters, but there's like, you know, like they're describing like what happened. It's supposed to be like a history of the zombie war after it happened.
Right.
After it happened. So like, it's a very like kind of slow and cerebral book, even when they're describing the action. And like, there are whole chapters where like describe like how they came up with the tactics to defeat the zombies.
And then it's the like, movie, I haven't seen the movie, but I just remember shots in the trailer where there's like Brad Pitt running away from,
from like a million zombies. Yes, exactly. So it's like, you could have totally seen them just taking the IP.
For sure.
But I think it may have been that John Le Carré just did a good job of keeping control of his IP. I don't know of any of like, you know, there are better and worse adaptations, but I don't know of any that have like tried to James Bond.
No, you know what's funny is as we were talking, I kind of just looked up John Le Carré adaptations, and some guy, it was actually April of 2022. The website is called The Best Films of Our Lives.
Okay.
And he has kind of ranked his top 10. And I was looking through them. There's actually a few, interestingly, that we'll have to watch that I didn't even know that they made. I know we talked about the fact that there was a Looking Glass War movie in 1970.
Yeah.
So that one's on there. But they did A Perfect Spy in 87. They did A Little Drummer Girl in 84.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And they did A Murder of Quality, which I'm really interested in 91. So they did a whole bunch of these. But looking at them, they're all like, none of them, especially the ones that I'm familiar with, even the more recent ones like The Night Manager and A Most Wanted Man, and even The Little Drummer Girl,
and like, Constant Gardner.
Yeah, I mean, that's great too. They, none of them, I think what that speaks to, if I'm being honest, is that I think people who are wanting to make John Le Carré books into movies are people who love the books.
Yes, they don't.
I think studios are saying, this is some great IP we have to, you know, turn into big blockbusters. I think it seems to be often driven by people who really like the books, love Le Carré's work, and want to try and do a fun but faithful adaptation.
Yes.
It doesn't, you know, they, and really, I just don't think they really lend themselves to the kind of James Bond treatment. But you could see, you can just envision, though, like a studio trying and just making a horrible.
I mean, I think the action-packed adaptation, the closest to not trying to make an action-packed adaptation, but like kind of what seemed like, of the ones I've seen, studio interference is like the change of the ending of Tailor of Panama from, that. Like, that is probably the closest I've seen of, like, oh, we need a happy ending.
Yeah, like, they make Tailor of Panama into a bit more of a comedy. Like, the book's very funny too, but the book is crushingly depressing also.
Yes, and particularly the ending is crushingly depressing. Yeah. And like the ending is not in.
No, yeah. So maybe that's, but still, I haven't seen that movie in a while, but it's still a pretty fun movie. And it doesn't. It's also one of the few John Le Carré books where I think that doesn't hurt it as much.
No, know? It doesn't. I mean, I like the book better than the movie, but for sure, neither of them are my favorites of what he's written.
So I guess, a few things maybe to talk about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. So it, like we said, it's a very complicated plot. They do have to go back and forth through time quite commonly. Again, it's so hard to talk about this from our perspective because we know the story quite well. We've seen the movie multiple times. Having said that all, it never felt super hard to follow for me. Now, we talked again about how other people we know didn't have that opinion, but I do think that if you've got any familiarity with this type of genre,
yes,
you know what I mean? I don't think it's something that's hard. But people who are coming to it from, like, Erin has never seen Star Wars. She doesn't watch like genre films of any.
No, Sarah does. Sarah's not. I think she's seen one Star Wars movie. Like,
yeah,
it's the same.
So it's like, you know, not to say that this is the same as Star Wars, but there are people who just avoid genre films for the most part, right?
If you don't know the tropes
beforehand,
this can be harder to like follow.
And they throw a lot at you. I mean,
yes.
Even the whole, you know, one of the funny things was, the scene when Jim Prideau is kind of back as a teacher.
I think
that's super confusing because I think it's very easy to see that and not realize that, okay, he didn't die.
Yep.
Because you don't actually find out technically, like no one tells you he didn't die until later on. So part of, I think some people watching that are like, oh, that must be a flashback, but why is he a teacher at the school?
Yes.
I thought he was a spy. How does this school fit in at all? So there's some things like that I could see why people get tripped up on it. But yeah, you know, speaking of awesome scenes, that whole Hungary scene is so good. The when he's sitting down with his contact and they're chatting, and he's like looking around at everyone, and you just get that great sense from the filmmaking of every single person he looks at. He's like, yeah, that could be definitely an agent. That could definitely be an agent. And then the biggest giveaway obviously is the waiter like sweating crazy.
And the woman like looking down and then closing her window.
Yeah, because obviously she seems pretty. She seems clearly to be a civilian, but she's like,
something's happening.
Yeah, something weird is happening down there outside my window that I look out of every day. And so that whole scene is great. And the kind of my favorite part of that is how there's the tragic part where the guy shoots the mother. Accidentally. I don't remember if that was in the book, but that was kind of a good. I liked that detail.
Because
I think it shows just how many innocent bystanders get caught up in these.
I mean, it shows how dirty of a business this is. Like, as much as you want to like Smiley and like all these characters, like they are involved fundamentally kind of dirty and dangerous activity that hurts people. maybe it's for a better cause, maybe it's not. I mean, yeah. There's the line when he's talking to Clarla where he's like, can't you see there's as little worth on my side as there is yours?
Yeah.
It's like, that is to me the epitome of John le Carré's books.
Yeah, that's probably the single, if you had to pull one quote from his whole work that explains his views and why all the books are so good is that quote. But I love the part in that scene just after the waiter's kind of freaking out and shooting, where the Russian
just like, you, like
the guy who's leading the operation is just walking out screaming like, you Hungarian amateur,
you idiots, you morons. Yeah.
And that's so perfect because it is almost like you're shooting a film. And when he comes out, he's got like the big headphones on,
yep.
He's got the cables on, and he's like, what the fuck? Like, cut, 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 do this again. I love that scene. And I think, again, from how do you successfully adapt a movie, I think you needed a scene like that has a bit high stakes right off the bat.
Yes.
Where the book doesn't give you that, and the book doesn't need to give you that because it's such a different experience. But I think that was smart to put early on in the movie so people get some high stakes right away. Because it's really that, and then the other really kind of fun scene, I mean, there's tons, but the whole Ricky Tarr scene when Tarr comes back, talks to Smiley, and I also love the fact that, you know, Smiley does the wedge in the door.
Yes.
And he knows that someone's in there. And I think I think as soon as he walks in and kind of sees the mess, he knows that it's Tarr like instantly. So he's not scared or anything. But that whole scene where Ricky's explaining, you know, what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
I love the scene where he's, you know, he's there to kind of see if he can maybe turn this Russian, where are they? Istanbul? Is that where they're?
Yes, in Istanbul.
And then the first time he sees him at the club, he's like, this guy's obviously a spy. He's pretending to be way drunker than he is. That scene's great. But
actually, that scene is funny because the Russian dude is wearing like the most stereotypical 70s outfit.
Yes.
And like that paisley, disco, shiny
polyester
shirt and button downs and like pretending to be like drunk and coked out of his mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That was,
but like, it's like, he's like, oh, he is, you know, I think this movie does like with there does a good job of showing like how much acting all these people do all the time.
Yeah. No, I kind of love that. There's a, I can't remember the exact quote, but when Ricky says like, you know, you, if you've done this long enough, you learn to recognize.
Yeah. You can spot your own. Yeah.
And so, you know, these people all have these things that work against normal people to trick people. But if you know what to look for, it's an obvious.
He stands out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. But that whole, the whole Ricky Tarr, I guess, montage or whatever you want to call it, I thought was really well done. And, you know, it also gives you really, I guess, kind of the only gore when he finds the other,
yes,
British agent there, like with his head kind of,
yeah, and then the up, you know, the Russian spies kind of gutted,
yeah,
too,
yeah, yeah. So, oh, right, yeah, exactly, yeah. So,
that Irina walks in on her,
yeah, husband. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yep,
yeah. And that whole scene was really well done, and again, they also do, I think, a good job. I can't imagine they shot that in Istanbul.
No,
because there's not really any scenes. Maybe they did just some exteriors or something, but all the scenes are, again, like in rooms. There's the scene when they're on the dock, but there's nothing specifically Turkish.
There's nothing specifically Turkish.
Yeah,
I mean, in the commentary they said they basically shot it all in London, so I wouldn't be shocked if they sent like one camera there to do a few exterior shots, and then just did everything in.
But it works. Like, you never.
No, it doesn't. Like,
this isn't Istanbul.
No.
But it's because of the type of, you know, kind of.
It's like the lighting and the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
but
they,
like.
They, you know, they add enough little flourishes in each set that you know that it's not in London. And it's, if they say it's a symbol, okay, it seems like it's Istanbul. So yeah, like that whole scene is really great. Are there any scenes that jump out to you as particularly, I've got like my favorite scene I'll talk about after.
Yeah, we can talk. So Yeah, I have some. I have some favorite scenes. One thing that did jump out at me, because I'm just like things that I always pick up new things whenever I'm watching. So I really love the scene, the whole sequence of Smiley sending Gwillem to steal the logbook of the night.
That's really good.
And then coming back, and he then sees Ricky Tarr for the first time and is like, because he had been grilled and is like, Ricky Tarr got $30,000, and he just starts beating the shit out of Ricky Tarr. And I mean, Tom Hardy plays that so well. He just sits up and spits out blood after he's like, but so
and
that
I love
scene,
how Smiley doesn't react, because he you can tell he's like,
I knew this was going
to
happen.
He needs to get that out of his system. And it's legitimate.
If that was my agent I was running, and and he disappears for 6 months or a year or whatever, and then pops up. There's that whole scene, and the way they play it with like having, you know, because you have to check in your bag so you can't steal anything, and then
there's
goes,
a million different checks you have to do, like for
and then he goes and he has like the car, the Mendel call in pretending to be his car mechanic, and he's like come on, just give me my bag so I can write it down, and he slips the thing in the bag. But there's, if you notice, there's this music playing and everyone like starts singing it, like the person who's like recording all the phone calls starts singing the song. And is humming, and then like everyone in the, like Mendel and everyone else in the shop is like singing along and humming to it. And so what I noticed for the first time this time is when, after Gwillem kind of got the third degree from Alaline and everyone about Ricky Tarr being a traitor and getting $30,000, Gwillem's going down the stairs after getting his bag, and he passes Roy Bland him, and he's singing the song.
Oh,
which,
my God,
like,
I didn't notice that.
He's singing the song. I mean, he's not doing it to the tune, but that, I like clicked to me like, oh, those are the words of the song. And it's like, oh, so I'm guessing Gwillem also knows, like, oh, he was listening, like they were recording that call. And I'm sure he knew they were recording the calls.
That they add, because there's a scene where I think it's one of the, like, you know, secretaries or whatever is recording a conversation between talking about Esther Hazy or House. I can never remember.
Yes. Esther has.
So it's like almost everywhere you are in this building, people are recording your conversation, and not just listening, they're writing it down. And so, you know, it I think it does a good job to really raise the tension in that scene where, you know, this is a building filled with spies who their whole thing is understanding how to steal information.
And they're spying on each other. It's not just they're spying everywhere else.
Right.
But they're spying on each other, and they can't find the mole, though.
Right.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, no, you're right. That's such a, that's
but it's like, there's just so little I was like, oh my gosh, like that, like the fact that that got like sent through. And that's like, oh yeah, it took me this many views to pick
catch
up
that.
On that.
No, that's such a good one. The another short scene that I kind of forgot about was, I totally forgot about the scene when Smiley kind of tells Gwillem at some point, like, hey, this is getting really intense. You need to kind of wrap up.
Oh, yes.
And which you find out in this scene is gay. He goes back and basically, like, you know, kicks his boyfriend out of the house.
And this is a big change from, this is one of the big, because he is not in the books. He is not.
Yeah, yeah, gay. Right. So,
which I like. I like this change. Like,
I thought it was good. Yeah,
I thought it works very well.
I think,
particularly for a movie like where you can't, like, you need to do like quick things to build up character development, where you can't, like, and I think this does it very well to build, like,
totally. And I think what Gwillem's it does character. As well is it adds some complexity to Gwillem's character, who at the beginning is maybe one of the weaker, just in terms of he just is kind of errand boy, but then it gives so much more complexity. And especially because in some of the earlier parts of the film, there's that scene when there's the new secretary who I can't remember her name.
Belinda, the blonde.
Yeah. And Hayden is kind of like doing locker room talk with Gwillem.
Yep.
And so you right off the bat are like, oh, is Gwillem kind of a ladies' man or whatever?
Well,
right?
I also noticed, this is more, I noticed more for the first time that a lot of the secretaries are hitting on Gwillem.
Yes. Like, yeah, because he's
the one
young,
in the library. Yeah, he's young and attractive, like the one in the library. Belinda remembers to give him his like briefcase when he's leaving.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, and it's like.
Well, and then there's the whole thing about spies and identities, and that whole theme is like,
well,
especially
I mean,
in the '70s too, right? You know, that I'm sure was being a gay spy was probably not something that was encouraged.
No, but I mean, it's lightly, big but. With like, I think this is hinted at in the books. I don't think it's as big as like shown as much as it is, but like Bill Hayden and Jim's relationship was obviously
right.
More than
no,
just
that's
friends.
True. There's some erotic.
There's definitely there. Like because at a particular in the scene I know you're going to talk about is your favorite scene. Yeah. He says, and there's a boy, and give him some money too. Like it's job. He has you know, he's sleeping with Anne. He has another girlfriend.
And then
there's a boy. Like there, you know, Hayden is always putting. You know, he has just so many different.
Yeah. Well, we're not far away from the Summer of Love, right? So I mean,
no, I mean this is 72, 73, we're
a bit more.
I mean, there's like also like particularly in kind of these, you know, the British spy service was a lot of upper class people, and there's kind of that undercurrent of like in boarding schools of you know these relationships.
Well, and a lot of kind of art people and philosophy people and probably places that stereotypically you would probably be it would not be uncommon, I guess, to find people with alternative lifestyles, let's say.
Yes. Completely. So, I mean, it's like a place where you can hide your lifestyle. Because like that's all a spy does is hiding.
Everyone's hiding. Yeah, exactly.
I guess before we get into your scene, I guess one of my other favorite scenes is when Smiley goes to visit Connie Sachs.
Oh,
I love Connie Sachs.
Yes.
And like the scene, you know, just one, I just love the character of how like, you know, it's obvious it's from the 40s to the 70s. Like she probably should have been running the place, and she's obviously kind of, you know, basically sidelined because she's a woman.
Yeah.
But like, cause she's like notices and remembers everything. Like she's
She's like the true brains.
Yes. She's like 15 years ago,
I thought.
She runs
the research department, right?
Yep.
Like that was, so she knows everything.
Everything.
Whatever, but...
And she was like, 15 years ago, I noticed Polyakov, and then I saw him getting saluted, and I was like, why is the culture attaché getting saluted? And then she gets fired. But I love her as a character, and I love how their whole, like, she remembers everything and gives everything, you know, so much help.
Yeah.
To Smiley. But I love what really stuck out to me this time was, I was about to say it. Sorry.
Well, while you're thinking, I'm just going to say one thing about it and
yeah, go ahead.
Jog your memory. The great part about that scene, and I think in the book, I think this scene might be my favorite scene in the book, actually. Because it's a bit longer and she kind of breaks down effectively after leaving. And
yes.
I think you get that in the movie, but the book draws it out a lot more where
she's like her alcoholism.
She's an alcoholic. She has zero purpose. She's incredibly sad and kind of depressed. And she's living in, I think it's her house. I think it is her house, but she's almost like
boarders.
And she has all these kind of art student boarders, and she's kind of just not living vicariously through them. But I think it's like the only thing that's keeping her alive, basically, is having these young people around. And it's just so crushingly sad that she got kind of swept up in all this. And there's a real, the best part about the scene, I thought, in the movie is the part where, you know, she says as Smiley's leaving, she's like, when you find out who it is, don't tell me. Like, I want to remember all of you as you were, like, during the war.
Yep.
And Smiley even makes
so that's spot. What that's okay. That was that.
Okay. Okay. You,
that's what jogged me was like,
yeah, yeah.
The whole part where she was like, weren't we so happy back then? And Smiley's like, it was the war. Like, yeah. You know, like everyone was dying. And, yeah. You know, like her response is a little cheesy. It was like, well, at least we, you know, it was like.
Yeah, good to be a British. Good.
It was like a gentleman's war or whatever. I forget what she says, or a real war or something.
Yeah.
But like the whole, like her, that I think is the best character, you know, best like summation in the movie of her character. Has like getting fired has destroyed her because she had nothing.
That was her whole identity. That period was what made her, and you could kind of see what she might have been like in her life previous to being involved in the war effort.
Yep.
You know, maybe super nerdy, awkward, not really well liked. But in the circus, she's the head of research. She knows everything about every little. You know, German officer and what they look like and where they live and what booze they like. And then, you know, into the Cold War, like every Russian attaché around the world, you know, who they are, where they're from, ex-military. Like she was, you know, she was the computer, right?
Yeah. I mean, she was like, her brain was the like mainframe of the, and I think it's like, it is, I think this was a big thing for a lot of women who, they got a lot of, because all the men were out in the war, they got a lot of authority during the war.
Yeah.
And then they came back and they're like, wait, why? You trusted me during the war, but now, like, I can't, you know, I'm guessing she was doing, you know, head of research is big, but I'm guessing she was doing even more during the war.
Oh,
like
for
running
sure.
operations and
I'm sure.
Things
yeah.
like that. So.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's that what the hell's the Benedict Cumberbatch Turing movie called? I can't remember. Imitation Game.
But oh,
they kind of talk about that in that movie as well a little bit, because there are some women involved in that project too, because there's all these obviously incredibly smart women around that they're like, look, we just need any smart
person. Need like right now we need anyone.
We need them now. It is literally life or death. We're gonna temporarily look past our sexism and get just the best people we can. And then, you know, war's over and a little bit back to normal, right? I think that's a great scene too. And she really is an amazing character. When we do the book, we'll probably break the plot down a bit more. We don't want to do that here because then when we do the book, won't be as interesting. But she really, if you read the book, you will really, I think, take away that her character is one of the best bits, and in the movie too. She's only in that one scene, but she really makes it work. So I'll talk about quickly my favorite scene now, which is, you know, we're in pretty big spoilers at this point. I don't think actually we've really spoiled anything up till now.
I don't think we have, but I mean, this podcast is always spoiled everything.
If you want to not know who the mole is, turn it off now. But so one of the final scenes, which is, you know, there, I don't know, this is coming from like a movie idiot. Like, I don't know anything about movies, but I think there are certain movies where you get these big scenes that are, they feel like action scenes and they feel really intense and percussive, but they're just two really good actors acting at each other.
Yep.
And the scene where Smiley and Hayden are talking when Hayden has, so Hayden's been caught at this point and they put him in the, what would you call it? Kind of the nursery, right? That's what they call it.
Sarat. I think it's sort of like the training area.
So it's kind of a training area.
Prison.
There's a prison there. And that's where they're kind of, you know, debriefing Hayden. Not torturing him though, apparently.
No.
But
he said, I mean, he does say he's like, I taught them everything, but he's like, it's still an emotional release after having it used on you. Cause he's
kidding.
He's crying. He's like, it's still not, even for him, it's not easy.
No. And so that whole scene, it's short. I mean, it's like 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's literally, so the thing I love about it is, again, probably a lesser movie spends time of the interrogation of Hayden in some way.
Yeah. But
that's not really important in this movie, because what's important is
they caught the mole.
Smiley succeeded.
Yep.
And Smiley has to, in his very particular, you know, few words way, get a couple things from Hayden. And you kind of know also that Hayden doesn't want to really give Smiley the satisfaction.
No, no, not at all.
But he just asks like four or five pointed questions, and they lead to these just couple, like the part, and like my hair stands up just thinking about it, when he's like talking about, you know, did Carla spare Jim because, you know, he was,
oh yes, yep,
thought it might, you know, the point he's making is, did he spare Jim because if he died he thought that you would kind of fall apart and wouldn't be able to do your mission or whatever.
Yep.
And then the part where Hayden's like, I'm not his damn errand boy, and then Smiley,
it's like, what are you? Yeah, in
the movie, he raises his voice, it's like, what are you then? That like couple minute exchange is just so amazing. I don't think that it could have been like, that is one of the things where the movie version of that scene done that well is better than the book, because you just, you can envision the book.
Yes.
When you see two really great actors portray that perfectly like that, it adds so much weight to it. And yeah, it just get, that scene gets me every time. Like, it's, that's a scene where I'll just randomly think of it and Google it and, I mean, and watch that
scene. It's an amazing scene. And then him talking about like finally saying like, I just, you know,
it was an aesthetic,
I'm sorry about, well, that, so that was gonna be next, but the first one, as you say, was Anne, where he's like,
right,
yeah, he, yes, thought, you know, he thought it would get to you and like make you not look past me, and he's like, he was right to a point. Yeah. Because you just like, it did distract him to a point.
Yeah.
Because, and you see that like earlier in the movie where like he's like, he knew he was sleeping with him. So he like, when Gwilym's like, oh, how did Hayden know? Like, how did Hayden know? And like,
but yeah, because you know, there's a big pivotal scene about Hayden says he was at his club
like, and he's like, there's no ticker tape at 1:30 a.m. Yeah. How did he know that Preto was shot and get over there? And you know, Smiley, in one of like his, I guess, you know, showing like he is fallible, he's like, yeah, oh no, he was just sleeping with my wife. Like, he was at my
house. Yeah.
And like, oh, you, and so he like, you know, it could have been wrapped up there if it wasn't for, you know, him. So, you know, he's like, it did, he was right, it did work to a point. But yeah, then yes, the line where he was like, it was more, you know, it was more an aesthetic choice than anything, the West is so ugly.
Yeah. I just love that. I think that
I love that line. Another...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
But,
yeah.
No, I love that line, but also I guess kind of it fills my theory of like John le Carré really viewing like he could have gone either way. Like, for he, sure, could have been, he could have been Bill Hayden, and he, yeah, didn't become it. But like that, like it like just fits into my theory about that so well.
Yeah, well, and I think the other thing it does at the same time is it kind of adds just more fuel to the fire of so much of these choices that are meant to be
super ideological. Yeah.
Are made not always for these super deep reasons. Yep. And sometimes he's like, yeah, you know what, it was an aesthetic choice as much as anything. I just think the way the West is going is gross, and I think there's a certain beauty and grandeur and whatever to the Soviet idea, and that was enough, you know. And the line where he's like, I you know, I was a man who made my mark, and you can tell Bill Hayden's the type of guy who he's like, I'm smart, I'm handsome, I'm the type of person who should do something that changes the world.
Yep.
And he's like, I'm not gonna do that in with the circus. So here's my opportunity.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's his response to Smiley when he says, when Smiley says, "What are you?"
What are you,
then? You know, and he goes, "I'm a man who made my mark." Like, yeah.
And you think, well, what a conceited thing for kind of a spy.
Yes.
Say, but then I think that is more true than I think a lot of people would want to realize about the people who get into these lines of work, where it's not all this noble, like, I'm here to serve my country stuff.
No.
It's a lot of, how can I do something that makes myself feel smart, or proves to other smart people that I'm smart, or does something that could change the world? Like, there's still so much of that ego and aesthetics that goes on. And I just love that scene gets to the heart of that. And I think it, it just makes a very broad political point too, which is, you know, this is super common in all stripes of politics, but maybe on the left you see it a lot too, is people who get into stuff and it's like, this just seems like the cool thing to do, you know?
Yep. Yep.
It seems like the cool team to be on. And that's not a bad thing in and of itself, but it just, I think, speaks to the fact that so many decisions that people want to believe are always these deep moral considerations.
Noble, yeah.
Not, you know, we're human beings and we've got many, many, many competing interests in our brains. And sometimes aesthetics wins out, you know? Like, I love that. And I love that Hayden's, like, honest enough in that moment to admit that, and that Smiley gets it out of him. It's just a really perfect scene.
And then I love the scene after that too.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition of Smiley walking into the circus as head.
While,
you know, Jim Prideaux, you know, he had cultivated that friendship with the little loner boy at the school. Yep. And he's like so depressed about what he has to do to his like best friend / lover that he like snaps at him and tells him to go away. And then, you know, shoots in one of the, you know, few, as I mistakenly said, one of the few gunshots in the movie, shoots Bill Hayden while he's crying, and just kind of the juxtaposition of like the end.
Well,
and
that
beginning.
Seems great too, because Bill sees him.
Yeah, well, that's okay. That was what I wanted to bring up. It's like, I always interpreted that as Bill knew he was there. Is that how you interpret
that's
it?
That's how I interpret it. Okay. Because there, to me, that there's, because they also juxtapose it with the party scene, right? The flashback.
Yes.
Party.
Yep. Where they're looking at each other.
Party,
yep.
Where Bill has the two drinks and he's looking around the room for Jim. And he notices Jim in the corner. And this is also at a point in time where Jim knows. Jim has some suspicions that Bill is the mole.
Yes, because he told. Because he also told Bill he was going hungry when he wasn't supposed
to. Yeah, exactly. So Jim's in the corner kind of looking sad. And then Bill is looking for him and catches his eye. And they share this really nice, you know, acknowledgement, friendly smile. And that's juxtaposed with the scene where Jim's points the gun at him and looks at him through the scope, and then Bill kind of looks at him. And I think that juxtaposition is purposeful, that they're kind of imitating.
That makes a lot of sense. And so, like, and then
I
Jim,
think him. And, Jim, and I think is, Bill is like, I want this. Like, I want you to get.
Oh yeah, yes. Of like, if anyone, like, I don't think he really wants to go to Russia. Like,
no.
And like, you know, when they're doing the scene at the party, you know, Jim really gives him a look. He's like, oh wait, like he really does like the look of like, oh, something is going on.
Yeah,
like, because I think that's right before he's supposed to go to Hungary. I don't know if he knows about it at that point.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly, because they don't really place. The only thing that we really know about the party scene is that George catches Anne and Bill making out.
Yes.
And that's like when his kind of suspicions are confirmed or whatever. But we don't really know when in the timeline exactly that takes place.
No. Yeah.
But that whole scene is also amazing. Like,
oh yeah. Lenin Santa singing the Soviet national anthem while, you know, everyone's singing it, and then Toby is like shaking his head like, what are you doing? And I mean, just also as I've tweeted the past 2 years, this is a Christmas movie. If Die Hard is a Christmas movie, this is a Christmas movie.
Definitely a Christmas movie.
So
that, and also, well, the soundtrack is amazing, both from the perspective of the actual, I guess, orchestral
soundtrack
is great, but they also have so many great songs. And the second best Secret Agent in the Whole Wide World song by
Santa Claus is incredible. Yes. Oh,
I mean, that has got to be at this point like one of my favorite songs ever. It's such a catchy song. And it's so, the thing I love about that is it's such a believable office party, right? Where, in the sense of these people who do this really serious job, but then at the office party, the whole
just get wasted
and make fun of themselves. Like,
yes. Oh, and Control,
how shitty you're a shitty secret agent.
When Control yells at Aliline for being a penny pinching Scott because he didn't put enough vodka in the punch.
It's gonna take us 5 hours to get drunk on this.
Get drunk on this.
Yeah. And then singing the international, the Soviet national anthem too.
Yes.
Like, you would, again, this is another
which is another view of like how of
it's like these people are doing this really serious job. And I think if you were to ask someone who took this, who thought all this, that all intelligence workers believed everything they were doing, yes, they would never do that.
And
they
hate the other side. Like they don't
saw the national anthem of the enemy.
No.
Well, that was amazing too.
Yeah. It's, I love that scene, the whole party scene. I mean, and that's where John le Carré himself pops up as just, you know,
he stands up to sing the Soviet national anthem.
Which is an amazing.
Yeah.
And is like, it's just like, I've been at office parties like that, not in the '70s, but like the, you know, 2010s, the 2010s version of those office parties.
The last quick scene we can talk about, because we were texting about this too, was it's also a really, I think, effective, because it totally breaks, you know, the movie is quite tense and there's a little violence but nothing crazy, and then we basically have this 1 minute horror movie interlude when Jim Prideaux is being interrogated in the Soviet Union, after he was captured and hungry. Them off to wherever. I mean, I can't remember if we know where he is, but obviously he doesn't know where he was. They wouldn't want him to. And oh, that whole scene is just so perfect. So the start of the scene,
harrowing,
is this pink cheesy 70s cheap wallpaper.
Yep.
And then you're slowly panned to the back of Jim's head. He's sweaty. He's got these huge headphones on. And every like 10 seconds, there's just this horrible cacophony of like screaming and yelling and crying babies. And then it cuts out. And then it goes on.
And my favorite juxtaposition in that scene is you just have the woman sitting in the background, like leafing through a magazine, like making sure he doesn't like that the music doesn't cut out.
Yeah,
or the noise, he doesn't like fall asleep or whatever.
Yeah.
And but otherwise, it's just like, I'm bored at my job. I'm going to read my magazine while they're literally torturing
2 feet away. And then you know, the horrible part where they bring in what's her name, Arena,
yeah,
they bring in Arena and they're like, do you know this woman? And this, to just to connect it, was the woman that Ricky Tarr kind of fell in love with, who told him about the mole, and who ultimately, you know, in a weird way, really is the key piece of this whole story, because she's the one who really makes the thing credible, because everyone kind of thought Control was crazy.
Yes.
So they didn't really believe him when he said there was a mole. But Ricky Tarr being like a secondary source and hearing it directly from kind of a Russian agent is the thing that, or I guess not directly from a Russian agent, but from a Russian agent's spouse or whatever.
Yeah. Well, no, but because he said that she is also a spook. Like that she was also, a spook.
Yeah, you're totally right. And then so they bring her, because she was captured in Istanbul.
Yep.
They put her in front of Jim Prideaux and they're like, do you know this woman? She gives him this heartbreaking smile. And it's like, I don't know this woman. And then they just shoot her dead right in front of him.
It's like, tell and Control what we did. Horrible. Or Aline. I think at that point they might have said Aline.
Yeah. And then, we see the back of Carla, because I think Carla kind of walks into
place
at that point.
Yep.
And that's it. And it's this tiny, again, like 2 minute scene, but God, it's so harrowing. And it's probably the most disturbing. Maybe it's the most disturbing film scene of any Le Carré adaptation that I've seen.
Yeah. It is a very harrowing,
because they don't really get
really rough.
I'm trying to think of any of the other books that they get into torture that much. They mention it a lot, but I don't remember too many scenes where they are super. A Most Wanted Man kind of has that scene.
Yeah, with the scene where they're,
It's not torture like that. It's more of like an intense interrogation, but
yeah,
this is just like full on torture. Anyway, brutal scene.
The kind of two other things I wanted to bring up before. They're quick.
Yeah.
So the first is Le Carré, when he's talking to Prideaux about like his interrogation, he's like, so what did you bury down deep inside? Like, what was the one thing you were never going to give up?
Right.
because, you know, there's always a breaking point where you like, you give up everyone. And he's like, the mole hunt. And then he's like, oh, but he knew, he came in and was like, knew this was happening and just wanted to know the progress. and then it becomes apparent that the, he also didn't have to hide this, but that what he was really hiding was his relationship with Bill Hayden.
Right.
Was like the thing he was keeping deep down from kind of everyone.
Right.
That kind of people, at least that was my kind of interpretation.
Yeah, I think that's very plausible interpretation.
And then the thing I wanted to bring from your, like, kind of the where Smiley is talking to Hayden, mm-hmm. the scene right before he walks in where Alaline is coming out with no tie on, no umbrella,
and oh yes,
soaked by rain, like just completely depressed, like, you know, his life has been ruined, he's been ousted from
and
the circus,
gives Smiley that one little look as
little look he's... and Smiley walks in, you know, like, you know, kind
got
of
the umbrella up and he's up. Like
yep
victorious, yeah, oh that yep. that is great, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I think in summary, I just really, you know, and it's funny, when we started talking about this, I was talking about that top 10 list, and Tinker Tailor, the movie, is number one on that list. And I think that, you know, people have their favorite books, and the books, I think, are maybe, there's so much to love in every book, even the ones that aren't as good, right? But they're so, because they're all just, you know, their books compared to movies, they're just a different beast, and there's so much more detail and so many things to pick out and focus on for the adaptations. And there's been some really good ones. There really has. I mean, The Constant Gardener, I watched that movie before I even knew who John le Carré was. And I love
sure.
that. There's been some really great movies with great actors in it, you know, going all the way back to the '70s. Or even the 60s.
The Spy Who Came from the Cold. Yeah.
You know, really great adaptations, but I think for the era this was made in and this material they adapted from, I truly just don't think you could have done better. I mean, again,
I don't think you could have done better as a film. I could see a miniseries being as good.
Yes, I could see that too. I think the only problem you would have is there's no way you would get the same cast, probably.
No. I'm just talking about like the Alec Guinness miniseries more than anything.
You know, I say that, and then the little drummer girl had a pretty.
It's true. I mean, like now it's like, you know, TV's getting movies, you know, TV's getting so many. Yeah. You know, it doesn't have the stigma it used to.
No. Like, it doesn't. And I think that would actually be really cool if someone were to want to give this another shot. And do the full Carla trilogy. You probably would have to do it as a show and do like a 3-season thing, each season being one book. The only thing you'd have, like, you just won't get that same cast. Well, obviously you won't because John Hurt's dead, but I think all those actors now are, you know, not all of them. I'm sure half the actors would still do it, but
I'm sure you could get them. It's just going to be a lot more expensive,
right? Exactly. and are you going to be able to get Colin Firth to sign to a 3-season TV show? Like, I don't know.
Yes, maybe.
I guess for the right money, I'm sure you could.
Yes,
but I guess the way I think about it is, I have a hard time seeing another adaptation get made that's as good. And
agreed.
The book is perfect in a completely
different
way, but I really think this is a perfect movie. I mean, you know, there's a lot going into this, but it's for sure one of my favorite movies of all time. I love
it. Oh, yes. Yep. I love this movie.
And I think a lot of people, frankly, who, again, who maybe have a bit more of a understanding of spy fiction and genre films and stuff, who are not big le Carré fans, like this movie. Like, I think there's an appreciation just for how well done the movie is, regardless of the source material. So it kind of seems to have some level of cult status at this point.
That's hard to
judge, but on Twitter, I feel like there's a lot of people who like it. But yeah, so, I mean, obviously if you haven't seen it and you're listening to this podcast, you need to see this movie. It's like, watch it this weekend. You will not be sorry. and be sad like we are every time you watch it that they didn't turn it into a trilogy. Because
yeah, every time,
how cool would it be to see like the Vietnam stuff?
An Honorable Schoolboy, yeah.
Or the what is it? Is it, I think, Singapore and Honorable Schoolboy?
Yeah, it's Singapore and Honorable Schoolboy. Or Hong Kong?
Hong Kong? Yeah, maybe it's Hong Kong. Anyway, just the potential that could have been. But then also, to maybe backtrack, maybe in a way, we're lucky that, you know, the thing that I love about British TV and so many of my favorite shows are British is that they never overstay their welcome. And they could always have done 2 more, 3 more seasons, 4 more seasons and ruined the show.
Yep.
But they never do. They make just the perfect amount. And maybe the greatest thing about the Tinker Tailor movie is that they just made this one.
Yeah. Movie, yep.
You know? And
it's like, now I don't have to be disappointed when half the cast doesn't come back for, you know.
You're like, oh, I wish the Honorable Schoolboy had a bigger budget because they had to shoot the Vietnam stuff in London again. And it did not look like
I mean, I heard from what I've read is that they might have even been like just doing Smiley's people and not doing, you know, they're just
that's what they did for the show, which
I show. Because I heard it was back then was maybe now too, was that all the Far East stuff was too expensive to film.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, exactly. So anyway, I mean, we obviously both love it. We know Emma loves it. When we do the book, we'll get Emma to give her her quick 5-minute summary of the movie too.
Well,
but
and what we just also have to do is just like do what Jeff Bezos did, become billionaires, and then pay to have our favorite
things. Yes. God, can you imagine the world where Jeff Bezos is cool and he is like, you know what? I'm going to create a team to do just a John Le Carre TV show and just do every single.
It's possible because that's what he did for The Expanse. Like that's the story behind The Expanse was Sci-Fi canceled it. He loved it. So he brought it to Amazon Prime. And it's like, oh, I wish,
only he was into, spy fiction.
Yes, exactly.
Although I'm glad. I'm glad
that's
one of the few good things Bezos has done is the bring The Expanse back. So, I mean, credit where credit is due. But okay, here's the last thing. Here's our last question. Who's going to be the billionaire, future world mogul that is going to be the Le Carre savior?
Yes, if any billionaire is listening to this, we will make a lot more episodes too if you want to pay for this.
Well, hey, and you can pay for this if you want to do like a, an accompanying podcast to the production, look, you're staring at us right in the speaker right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or maybe Soros, maybe he'll do it. Maybe we can get some Soros money.
I mean, I'm already getting Soros money.
Well, you are, yes, but I'm not lucky enough to be getting.
I'm sorry. Guess.
It's my Canadian citizenship.
Yeah.
So that's it. That's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the movie. We love it. Go see it. And this is Tinker Tailor Podcast Spy signing out for this episode. Yes. Happy New Year. And we will be back with more John Le Carre goodness in the near future. Let's say February.
Yes. We have not picked what we're going to be doing, but we will.
Know yet.
We
probably, because we haven't given ourselves a ton of time yet, probably be another movie or TV show.
I think it'll probably be another movie or TV show,
or article or something. There's some, we've talked to some people who are somewhat interested in doing some guest stuff, so hopefully this year we'll have some fun stuff to bring to all the Le Carre heads. So thanks for sticking with us over the break, the self-imposed break, and we will catch you next time. Thanks, everybody. Bye.